Hello and welcome to Talking HE. My name is Santanu Vasant. This is a special episode to mark the 30th anniversary of the Association for Learning Technology, ALT, the Joint Information Systems Committee, JISC, and the Staff and Educational Developers Association, CEDA. In this episode, we speak to Professor James Wisdom. James is CEDA Company Secretary, Chair of Educational Development's Editorial Committee, and Series Editor of the Routledge published CEDA books. We discussed the landscape of higher education before CEDA, why CEDA was formed, James's memories of CEDA in the early days, and where he sees the organization in 2 to 5 years. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm James Wisdom, and I've been involved with CEDA for most of my working life. When I got into what was then Kingston Polytechnic, became Kingston University, and I've been a freelance educational development consultant for really rather a long time. I think that's pretty well it.
What were your encounters with CEDA or its predecessors?
My first encounters with CEDA were with an organization called SCEDSIP, which was the Standing Conference of Educational Development Services in Polytechnics. It really tripped off the tongue. That's one of those one of those brilliant names. And SCEDSIP was an organization which brought together a variety of people. Some of them were educational developers of the sort that we would now recognize as educational developers. There were a gang of folk who had been appointed in the what was the university sector, who had been often given a sum of money to organize educational development workshops, teach training workshops of one sort or another. And there was a sort of technology component of people who came mainly from a television background, because there had been a previous wave of hope that television would be one of the technologies of the future. And then there was a fourth group of people who were members of the Society for Research into Higher Education, who were doing educational development. And they felt very out of place inside SRHE, because there was no need, demand to do classical traditional research. And CEDA was formed when, at the same time as that group of people decided to leave SRHE, and they were one of the constituent parts of CEDA. And then very soon after that, there was a group of technologists. Forgive me, I can't remember the name at the moment, but they had got the journal. They had already organized a journal which was called Innovations in Technology and Education International. And they wanted to join CEDA. And the really good thing about them was that they got an enormous amount of money from the various conferences they'd been running. And so we thought this was a nice nest egg. They were also extremely heavy drinkers, and on the first CEDA conference, they managed to consume most of the surplus that they brought with them. But that's another matter altogether.
What was the higher education landscape like before CEDA?
Well, my experience is that there was educational development work going on, and effectively CEDA brought what there was together into one organization with a clear, credible name. The question, what sort of educational development was going on? I think there are probably two or three bits of that, if I may. One is that we had had, a lot earlier, we had had the Robbins Report into Higher Education, which was a strategic plan of the future of higher education. And Robbins said a variety of things, some of which were not contentious, but were good that they'd been brought together. The first was that we clearly needed to grow the number of graduates in Britain. So that's been a continuous theme in British political life since the 1950s. The second was that we could grow the number of graduates by building some new universities, but also by upgrading colleges of technology into university status. And so the Robbins universities, which were sometimes called the plate glass universities, were part of this sort of sleight of hand as more and more organizations, more and more institutions became recognized as universities. So, for example, the University of Surrey had been Battersea Polytechnic, Battersea College of Advanced Technology, and so then was upgraded to a university. That had really only happened a few years before the polytechnics were upgraded into universities. But my God, the snobbery went in pretty quickly. They were often describing themselves as old traditional universities and that the polytechnics were the new upstarts. So this process of upgrading organisations and calling them universities has gone on for decades. Teacher training colleges became universities and are now doing research. The further education sector thinks that its only chance of getting any serious money is to rechristen itself as the university sector and be upgraded into universities, the practical technological universities and so on. So that was all going on. It was government policy to expand the numbers in higher education, but not to expand the unit of resource. In other words, not to pay more for every student that came in. So for a very long time, our funding was capped, but we were expected to take more students every year. And that led to a perfectly straightforward political response, which was, well, we need experts to come in and teach us how to deal with these much larger classes. So there was a thread in education and development, which was coping with change, coping with the arrival of new students. Again, there was snobbery. These were the students who wouldn't have been accepted 10 years earlier. And so there were a lot of old-fashioned lecturers who were saying that the students were not fit really to be in universities. And there were a lot of other lecturers who were saying we needed to expand even faster. So, I mean, simple things like how to instill group work into higher education was a very common theme amongst early educational developers' work. And then the final thing which I think really mattered was that Robbins' report had done a survey of what staff development was required in universities. And you would have thought that this would have become the keystone of everything that we needed to do for the next 20 years. What the people told Robbins was that they only needed two sorts of training. One was how to teach large classes, and the other was how to teach seminars. That was pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. That was the comprehensive vision of the future of teaching and learning in higher education for the forthcoming generation. And that was the basis on which some of the academic developers were hired in the traditional universities to spend their pot of gold on people who would come in and teach teachers how to shout to the back of the room and how to run a seminar. Clearly, the educational developers who knew about pedagogy and were growing their experience very rapidly had a very different view of what higher education required.
What role did technology play in the early days of CEDA?
Technology has always been a dream that is chased by people who simply cannot face making hard decisions at the time. So there's always the hope that new technology of one sort or another will square the circle. And we had a whole series of initiatives that came into higher education that in a way promised new technology would be the basis for the future. Now, some of these were risible. I can remember I did actually hold in my hands Kingston Polytechnic's teaching machine, which was the size of a shoebox And it was two rolls of paper on two spindles and a little window. And it was a decision tree. So you were told five things. You were then asked a question. If you got it right, you were allowed to roll your paper forward very quickly. And if you got it wrong, you had to roll backwards and do it all again. This was not the solution to the future of higher education. But lo and behold, the moment that new PCs were installed, the teaching programs that were available on those PCs were exactly the same. Here we are. Here's a load of information. We will now test you. And if you've got the answers right, you can move on to the next information. So that sort of primitive technical solution could either be in a shoebox or on a computer screen, but it was still a very straightforward sort of decision tree process of education. And who is to say that some of that isn't still going on today? You hear it when you hear a lecturer say, there's no point in me testing these students until I've given them at least 5 weeks teaching because they don't know anything. So that's still the same theory. The next one, I think, was television. A lot of people thought that television was going to be able to produce high quality, mass production education. I blame David Attenborough. There's no question that his skills at telling stories, laying out narratives, and making people feel they understand snow or the depths of the ocean or the mating habits of the marmoset or whatever. Why can that not be translated into the classroom? And pretty well every university who got a television unit. We had television studios at Kingston, I remember very clearly. We had technicians who were buying the latest Japanese equipment. We could, if we wanted to, do remarkable things using television. There were even international collaborations. I think there was a 25-member institutional collaboration which was going to share television programs around the world. They don't work. They're not based on a sensible pedagogical base. But that doesn't matter. When the educational change-making process came in, it was classic that you would build the television people into that sort of process. I'm sure everybody can think of almost all the advances that we've had since the television one in exactly the same terms. Many of them promise the earth and are really quite difficult to incorporate. So here am I talking to a group of people from a technological background and saying something which everybody knows, and that is that it has to be pedagogically driven. But unfortunately, the technology is so tacky and glorious and enjoyable and playful that it overburdens the pedagogical requirements until we move on to the next piece of modern kit, which today is AI. Tomorrow, God knows what it'll be. We shall see.
Do you think the sector is still continuing to make the same mistakes?
I think there are two sorts of new technology. There's been the mass training of citizens in the simple, straightforward things like text and spreadsheets and PowerPoints and, you know, the sort of nitty-gritty of using the computer and the new mobile services on telephones. I've watched Teaching and Learning Technology Program. I've watched JISC investments. And I think it is really very hard to see if we've had real payoff benefits from those. I think there was a serious attempt when Graham Gibbs was asked by the funding council to design the answer to the question, why are we not making progress in these things? And his formula was that we needed institutional teaching and learning strategic plans into which advances, technological advances, could be inserted. And for some years, that process worked. But the Fund for the Development of Teaching and Learning, I remember very clearly, we gave money away. I was part of the group that did it. We gave money away to people with good ideas. They raced off and bought the latest kit. They had a fantastic time. And a year later, they would give a seminar back to their colleagues in the institution. And nobody could actually make it work because the institution hadn't got that level of kit. That was really tragic, but it happened frequently. Where is the CD-ROM?
What really sticks out for you about CEDA over the years?
What sticks out for me is the way that CEDA became almost an emotional haven for people who were leading relatively solitary lives. In many universities, there was only one educational developer, possibly one and a half, possibly two and a half. A CEDA conference, a chance to meet colleagues doing the same work in different places, was hugely important. And it was one of the ways that we grew the sort of collaborative sharing culture that a good professional association should have. And there were always people with a technological bent in those experiences. They weren't different people. It was a mixture of people doing all sorts of things. We had more than our fair share of philosophers. So whenever anybody said something about CEDA values, we were always in for a five-year debate about what those might be. So we had people from all walks of academic life. So I think it was the shared experience. And I think there was one transformative moment. I don't think it was a moment in time. I think everybody in the system was transformed by it. It sounds terribly corny. When we started, we thought the way of improving British higher education was training and teaching teachers to teach better. In almost all our cases, there came a time where we realized that that was an almost unresearchable, unachievable task. There was a researchable, achievable task, and that was when we shifted our focus to the focus on how students learned. And once we were looking at student learning, we were looking at something that was researchable, was identifiable, and it embraced a very much larger number of people than the number of teachers the students saw. So we were the Staff and Educational Development Service Association, and administrators, librarians, new technologists were all part of the CEDA family because we were all looking at the same focus, which was what do we need to do to improve the learning abilities of our students. And I think it's that shift, which doesn't happen in other countries. I've been to American educational conferences and they're still focused on what the teacher can do in the classroom. And quite honestly, if the teacher gets it right, they might not even need to be in the classroom. It's, you know, if they learn how to do curriculum design, and if you look at the typical, if you took, look at the typical module, it might be 150 learning hours, and it might only be 30 teaching hours. Well, let's focus on what the students are doing in the serious chunk of work. Not, you know, let's, the time in the classroom is driving a much larger time of the student's own work. So I think it was that transition from teacher performance to student learning that was hugely significant.
That's such a powerful point, and one that many have experienced as they've moved from teacher performance to student learning. Where do you see CEDA in the next 2 to 5 years?
That's one of those simple questions, which if you unpick it, it's in two parts. My reply is in two parts. I'll tell you what I think we are going to see, and if you've got the time, I will tell you what I would like to see, which may be very different. I don't think at the moment we're going to see a great deal of change in the shape of British higher education over the next 2 to 5 years. I think the universities are pretty powerful organisations which are happy to defend themselves. They have decades of experience in defending themselves, so they will remain universities which may be quite recognisable. There may be funding problems, there may be temporary blips, there may be new universities, who knows? But fundamentally, the model of higher education is probably going to stay the same. I don't see mature students coming into universities in the sort of numbers we had in the past and which some of us still hope for. We are still seeing a focus on 18 to 22-year-olds. Today's newspaper said that all universities should have care management for their youngsters. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a voluntary business. You do not have to come to university. At 18, you're an adult. There should be caring services for all British citizens, but I'm not absolutely convinced that universities are in loco parentis, are looking after the children of things that their parents would otherwise be doing. Now, that's uncomfortable, but I think we're going to carry on providing education to school leavers. I would like a year compulsory break from education at 18, so that people actually have to actively want to go to university at 19. That would make a huge difference, but it's not going to happen. So I think we are going to be coping with the current model for the next 5 years. You may have detected I'm not comfortable with the current model. I'm really not comfortable with it. When I first started teaching, I could walk along the corridor of any college or university and I would see people standing at the front talking to students sitting in desks. I think there are plenty of universities you could walk along their corridors today and you would see almost exactly the same thing. Now, I don't mind the stand and deliver model of higher education. That's fine. But I don't think it's remotely what we should be doing with the citizens of Britain who want to continue their education after compulsory schooling. So I'm looking for much more change. The other change which I cannot cope with is the notion that our current A-level selection process is a measure of intelligence. I'm not sure that it is. Why do estate agents put in their brochure for the sale of a house, the quality of the nearest school? Because basically you can buy your A-level point scores by moving to a really good school area. Don't tell me that that is anything to do with intelligence. don't tell me that the kids I was teaching in further education, who were the young apprentices, because they hadn't got into universities, they hadn't managed to get into universities, don't tell me they weren't as bright and as sparky and as intelligent as any of the students who are currently in universities. I cannot bear this. The notion that higher education is being actively used as a class divider. And if you would like me to say what I'd like to see, I would like to see that ended.
Thank you to Professor James Wisdom for his time. This was a special episode of Talking HE for the ALT, JISC and CEDA 30th anniversary. Thanks for listening. I've been Santanu Vasant, and this has been Talking HE.